Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And if you're not Catholic, we're holding the phone lines for you today. Why aren't you Catholic? We'd love to have that conversation with you. If you call and tell us why you're not Catholic, you'd be doing us a big favor. That'll make a good program. We, of course, are Catholics. That's why it's called Catholic Answers Live. But we sure love talking with people about Jesus, about the church, and about maybe your concerns about Catholicism. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Jimmy, we got the news today that Chuck Norris had passed. God bless him and rest his soul. He must be one of the most memed people in the history of the internet. I don't know if they keep records of this.
Well, I assume he's kicking butt in the afterlife now.
That's got to be on something somewhere. But you know that people people just love to make them a Chuck Norris meme. So
he was 86, so he got up to a nice age.
Yeah.
And which also coincidentally is a death number. But you know,
I don't know what that means. 86 is a death.
Well, it signifies death if you 86 somebody.
Oh, right, because of restaurants. That's an old restaurant terminology. If they're out of something, you have to 86 that item, meaning take it off the menu. So
I'm not sure that's the origin, but I'll have to look that up.
Well, that's what I heard. And usually if I hear it, it's true. Like if I hear it from a guy, I think probably someone I was sitting on a bus with or something. That usually turns out to be true information.
No, I'm not saying they don't use 86 as a code in restaurants. I'm just not sure that's
the origin of it. All right. Well, again, prayers for Chuck Norris and for his family, and bring on the memes. Looking forward to seeing what people come up with in the next few days. Why aren't you Catholic? Well, Eli is in Texas, in Dallas, Texas, as a matter of fact. Why aren't you Catholic, Eli?
Hello, my name's Eli. I'm 14 years old, and my dad, he's Catholic. I'm a mom, Seventh-day Adventist. And I attend, like, both a Catholic church and an Adventist church weekly.
Wow.
But the biggest thing,
A little closer to the phone, Eli, because I really want to hear what you're saying.
Eli, I think you may have your phone on speaker. If you could take it off and hold it directly up to your ear, that would help us out.
All right, can you hear me better?
Much better, yes.
Oh, much.
Thank you.
All right. So the main thing that I can't really understand about, like, Catholic theology and why I can't really fully accept it is purgatory, because as, like, Protestants, that's, like, something that they don't believe in, and it's not, like, in our 66 books of the Bible. And I was just wondering if you could explain and, like, enlighten me so I can figure out why we should believe believe that purgatory exists as Christians.
Okay. Now, you said that you, in addition to attending Catholic Church with, I guess, your father, you also go to a Seventh-day Adventist church. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I assume you have other family members who are Seventh-day Adventist. So the issue of purgatory is wrapped up with another issue that is not a source of concern for the vast majority of Protestants, but it does happen to be an issue that needs to be discussed when it comes to Seventh-day Adventists, because Seventh-day Adventists commonly adhere to a position known as Christian mortalism, or it's also sometimes called soul sleep. And the basic idea is that there are no conscious experiences that a soul has between the point of death and the point of resurrection. Is that something you're familiar with?
Yes. Like, I believe that it's...
Okay. Do you yourself, are you committed to that, or are you open to the idea that that there are conscious experiences between death and resurrection?
Well, for what I know so far, that's what I believe. But I'd really love to learn. And if you can, mm-hmm. like, you show me what you know, and I'll show you what I know, and come to a conclusion. But I believe that whenever you die, it's like a sleep. And whenever Jesus comes again, the second coming, we'll wake up, and then we'll go to heaven or hell, and there's not really anything in between, any purgatory and stuff.
Okay. Well, we should get this issue sorted out first before we hit the issue of purgatory. So let's see if we can do that. There on the traditional Christian belief, which is that there are experiences in the intermediate state between death and resurrection, which is the perspective of the overwhelming majority of Christians in world history of all stripes, there is no second dying. So everybody who doesn't live until the second coming dies at some point, but that's the only time it happens. So, you know, certainly before the resurrection, it's the only time that happens. So so that's the first point I'd make, because it sounded like you referred to not wanting to die again. And I would assure you, nobody in traditional Christianity believes you die again before the second coming. Having said that, do we have evidence that souls have conscious experiences between death and resurrection? And I would say, yeah, we have that in the New Testament. For example, and we also have it in the Old Testament, but I'll stick to the New Testament. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus tells the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, and both Lazarus and the rich man and the patriarch Abraham are all presented in the intermediate state between death and resurrection, and they're presented as having conscious experiences. The rich man is suffering, and the Lazarus and Abraham are comforted, and they have a conversation with each other. So we've got conscious experiences depicted for them in this parable. Now, you could say, well, this is just a parable, and that's true, or presumably true. It's the only one, I would just note, it's the only one of Jesus's parables where a character has a name. And that name, Lazarus, is the same as a guy we also know about who really did come back from the dead. So there's at least a question in my mind about how parabolic is this. But a more fundamental point I'd make is Jesus's parables are based on real-world situations. So he tells parables that involve kings and servants and fathers and sons and farming and harvests and all these different, and money, and all those things are real. They're in the real world. There are kings and servants and fathers and sons and farming and crops and harvests and money and all of that. So if that's true of Jesus's parables in general, it should be true of the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, which features conscious entities in the conscious human entities in the afterlife. So I would say we've got evidence here, not doesn't say it flat out, but I would say this gives us evidence that there are conscious human entities in the state between death and resurrection. But I don't have to stop there. Because if we go to the book of Revelation, we have multiple passages where there are humans in heaven who are depicted having conscious experiences, even though they're currently dead. Like under the fifth seal that Jesus unseals, when he pops the seal off, John hears the voices of the martyrs under the altar in heaven, and they cry out to God saying, God, how long are you going to wait before you do justice for us? And we're told the martyrs are told that they need to wait a little while longer until the full number of martyrs that are destined to happen have happened, and they're given white robes to comfort them. So here we've got these heavenly martyrs. They're dead because they're martyrs. They're in heaven. They're having conscious experiences. They're calling out to God. They're comforted. They are told to wait a little longer. We also have others. Later in Revelation, John sees a group of people coming up out of off of the earth, and his guide says, "Who are these folks, John?" And John's like, "Well, you're the heavenly guide. You tell me." And the guide says, "These are those who come up out of the great tribulation." So they're newly arriving martyrs who have just been killed for their faith. So they're having conscious experiences as well. So we, and this is not just something we find in these passages, we also find it in loads of Christian literature all the way down through history. In fact, I just finished a script for my Mysterious World podcast that's going to come out the last week of April, where I walk through early Christian literature and show examples of early Christians encountering the spirits of departed humans. This is something that's been there all the way through human history, and it's something we now have scientific evidence for, because since the 1970s, scientists have been studying near-death experiences where people come close to death, their heart may even clinically stop, so they are clinically dead, and yet they report having conscious experiences, and they interact with other people, including ones they knew who have been dead for a long time. They have conversations with God. They see, have a review of everything they did in their life. And in general, they show evidence of having conscious experiences even when they're in a state of death. So I would say both biblically and scientifically, we have evidence for conscious experiences in the intermediate state. So that's what I'd have to say about that. Cy Kellett is going to tell us we need to go to the break in a moment. So why don't we come back and talk about purgatory on the other side?
Oh, okay. Eli, if you'll hang on, we'll get this break done as quick as we can. We'll come back and talk more about purgatory with you. Catholic Answers Live, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Just one line open. If you're not Catholic and you want to tell us why, you can have that line. 888-318-7884.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Coming up on EWTN Radio, we're celebrating the Annunciation and remembering Mother Angelica. And of course, bringing you Catholic Radio's premier shows featuring Lent, A Season of Grace with Father Cedric Pisania, EWTN News in Depth, Sunday Lenten Reflections, The Miracle Hunter, and more. EWTN Radio, your source of truth that allows Catholics to grow in their faith and recognize the true mission of the Catholic Church.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Eli in Texas, in Dallas, Texas, on the line with us. Eli told us he's 14 years old. I think it's your father is Catholic and your mother is Seventh-day Adventist?
Yes, that's correct.
And you are struggling with the idea of purgatory.
Yes, that's what it is.
Okay.
So before the break, we discussed evidence for a conscious intermediate state between death and resurrection. So to deal with purgatory, I'm just going to assume that there is a conscious intermediate state. Although actually there is a way I'll get to where there would be a purgatory even without that. But for the moment, let's just assume there is a conscious intermediate state. Well, the purpose of purgatory is to free us from disordered desires that we have in this life that tempt us to sin. You know, this is mentioned in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, for example. So, it's clear, I would say, that we're not going to be sinning in heaven. You know, the Revelation says that nothing impure shall enter the heavenly city. So I would say we're not going to be sinning in heaven. But question for you, Eli, are you likely to be completely free of all temptation by the time you die? Or do you suppose that that you may still be dealing with temptation at the point of death?
No, I will not be free from all temptation and sin by the time I die. Not in the Pope, like, I know, like, he's tempted, but everyone we try, and no one's perfect. But to that, I would say that whenever we die and we be raised for the second coming, that whenever we get into heaven, we are in our same bodies. We take to heaven our character, but in there we cannot sin. There's no need.
Okay, Eli. Yeah, Eli. I'm not saying anything. You're not saying anything that I would disagree with at the point of the resurrection. But if I can tie up the chain of reasoning I was exploring, if you agree that you're still going to have to deal with temptation, and even if you personally didn't, loads of people do. Have to deal with temptation up to the point of death, and then you're not going to be sinning in heaven, whether that's at the resurrection or before the resurrection. Then between death and heaven, something has to happen to free you of those disordered desires that we call temptation. Now, how that happens is an open question. Whether it takes time or happens in a flash, in the twinkling of an eye, that's an open question, but there has to be something happens that frees us from those disordered desires. And if it doesn't happen before death, well, then it's going to happen after, but before heaven. So that's what Catholics call purgatory. And the Catholic Church doesn't really narrow down much more about purgatory than just there is this purification from disordered desires. And it might take time, it might not take time. It's done because of Jesus's work. You know, we're sanctified or grow in holiness over the course of the Christian life. And this is just the last, and we grow in holiness because of Christ's grace. And this is just the final application of Christ's grace to get us where we need to be in order to be ready for heaven. So that's all the Catholic Church teaches about purgatory. Now, it is commonly understood in among traditional Christians, including Catholics, that this is something that happens either at the beginning of or sometime during the intermediate state before we get to the resurrection. But even if you were absolutely convinced that there are no conscious experiences prior to the resurrection, well, okay, fine. That doesn't do away with the need for purgatory or purification of temptation. That's just something that would happen in the first moment when you wake up at the resurrection, and bam, God's going to heal you then. So the concept of purgatory really tends to be compatible with just about everybody's view of the afterlife in Christianity. And it would even be implied on the Seventh-day Adventist view. They may not use the term purgatory for it, but they would seem to acknowledge the reality of, yeah, if we're not perfect at the end of this life, we will be in the resurrection. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, thank you. You really answered my question. Like, the way that purgatory has been described to me or taught to me was a little different. So I think you kind of clarified it, and I can agree with most of what you just said. So, yeah.
Awesome.
Thanks a lot. Wow.
Yeah, no problem. And if you're interested in checking out additional information, like I mentioned, I've got that episode coming up in April about conscious experiences in the afterlife that have been reported in Christian history. The title of the episode is Ancient Christian Ghosts. You know, that's something you could check out. Also, a while back, I did a two-part look at Ellen Gould White, the sort of the founding prophetess of Seventh-day Adventism. I talked about her in episodes 229 and 230 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You could find those on my YouTube channel, or you could go to mysterious.fm/229 and mysterious.fm/230. And in them, I do not make a theological critique of Ellen Gould White. I did a lot of special research to just say, okay, how credible is she as a prophet? And so I did not do what many people do who have critiques of Ellen Gould White, where they look at theological disagreements they had. Instead, I just looked at, let's look at just the issue of prophecy. So I set aside all theological debate and just looked at both pro and con arguments for is she credible as a prophet. And I would also recommend episodes 229 and 230 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World to hear what I had to say about that. And I hope it's helpful.
Eli, I would like to send you that book, A Daily Defense, that Jimmy gave to a couple other folks. Answer a bunch of your questions about the Catholic faith. If you'd like it, give us an address and we'll send it off to you. We've never talked about 14, but I think that's old enough to give your address. If it's not, ask your mom or dad, and they can give us an address and we'll send it off to you, Eli. I'd love you to have it in any case. Let's go to Javier in Los Angeles, California. Javier, thank you for waiting. Why aren't you Catholic?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
So happy to, Javier.
I grew up around Catholicism as a kid, going to Mass and CTD and stuff like that. But I was never baptized or received any sacraments.
Really?
My mom was the one that would take us more often to Mass, but my dad wasn't really practicing Catholic himself. But when I was about 13, he had a strong conversion and took our family to evangelical Pentecostal churches, and it changed his life for the better. But for me, it was a culture shock. It kind of threw me off of like religion in general. So a lot of my 20s and 30s, I just was more agnostic atheist. But some struggles in my adult life, I started praying again, and now I'm at 40 now, and I'm drawn to Catholicism for some reason. Maybe something that I missed out as a kid, so my question is like, well, what advice do you guys have in a journey to learn more about the Catholic Church? I have family members that, you know, might fight back with even considering this idea, and those struggles just relation struggles of that I foresee.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me first ask you a question. So, are you presently married?
No.
Oh, okay.
I am actually divorced.
Okay. And do you have children that live with you?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask is, you know, you're an adult. And so even if you have family members who might oppose the idea of you exploring Catholicism or becoming Catholic, you're not under an obligation to tell them immediately. Now, if your wife was living with you, well, you'd kind of need to let her know fairly early in the process, not necessarily immediately, but and at some point before you would become Catholic, you'd need to let your kids know. But there's not an immediate urgent need to tell anyone what you're looking into. So if you foresee there could be conflict over this and you're not wanting to deal with that conflict at the moment, I would say, well, then look into it, do your study, but don't tell anybody, you know, because you're not under any obligation to tell anybody. What you do with your soul is your business. And we do have, you know, eventually people will need to learn about it, not necessarily before you become Catholic. When I was becoming Catholic, I didn't tell my parents initially, and I did let them know before I was received into the church. My wife was dying at that point, and so they kind of gave me a pass and didn't want to add any more weight to my journey at that point, given my wife was dying. Mm-hmm. But I actually never told my grandmother. I knew she would object very strongly. And rather than telling her myself and prompting a confrontation, I let her learn organically through the family. So she came to know that I was Catholic, and she didn't want to talk to me about it. And so she was not a fan of the Catholic Church at all. And so I used a non-confrontational way of letting her know rather than force the issue by talking to her directly. So in your situation, Javier, unless there's a special reason that someone needs to know, I would say you're not under any obligation to tell them. It's certainly not immediately until you know what you're going to do. So I'd definitely let the kids know if you decide you need to become Catholic, or even, you know, you want to start going to church and maybe bring them along. You know, that's all great. But I'd say take it easy and take it slow and just put one foot in front of the other at a time. I definitely want to make sure we give you a daily defense, though. So hang on the line.
Hang on, Javier. If you'll give us an address, we'll send you Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, and help you with that investigation. And call back anytime. We'll take a quick break. Right back with more Catholic Answers Live. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. A little bit of groovy music for you, helping you as you head into the weekend. We're awful glad you're here with us. Jimmy Akin, our guest. I have just really enjoyed the conversations today. I think putting Why Aren't You Catholic together with Jimmy Akin has been a stroke of genius on our part. And it's been a lot of fun. We've got several folks on the line. I think if you want to get in that line and tell us why you're not Catholic, we will be able to get to you today, 888-318-7884. Going to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Christian in Philadelphia. Welcome, Christian. Why aren't you Catholic?
I'm not Catholic because I just have a lot of disagreements with going on in the churches. Like, it's a lot of rituals, and I don't find that stuff in the Bible.
Like, okay.
Jesus said you should pray to the Father, and then there's only one Father. So I don't know why.
Yeah, Catholics do that.
Father. Yeah. Yeah, they're breaking the law already.
Oh, I see.
Oh.
Calling priests.
Okay,
Father.
Well, so let me see if I
so
I want to make sure. I'm sorry?
Are the priests trying to be the Father like God is the Father?
Nope. Priests are not the Father the way God is the Father. Let's deal with that subject first, and then we'll go back and talk about rituals, which was the other subject you mentioned. So, Christian, you're a human being, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, just wanted to verify. So you have a father, correct?
Yes.
And do you ever call your father father or dad or papa or anything like that?
I'm dad.
Dad? Okay. Is your dad dad in the same way God is dad or Abba?
No.
No. Okay. So we see there can be humans who are not God, and we're all agreed they're not God, who can be referred to as father, even though they're not fathers the way God is a father. So God's the ultimate father. We are agreed on that. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So then we come to a question now, because in Matthew 23, Jesus says, you know, call no man father and so forth. But was he intending to prohibit? We have to ask, what does he mean there? One possibility is that he's prohibiting anybody from ever using the term father for a human being. And he's wanting to restrict it to just being used for God. On the other hand, it's possible that he means it in a more restrictive way, like don't confuse anybody else's fatherhood with God's fatherhood. So we need to figure out which of those possibilities, and there could be others, but those are the two I'd like to suggest for your consideration. Which of those do we have evidence that supports? Would you say, Christian, that we have evidence that Jesus was prohibiting anybody from ever using the term father for a human?
Christian?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, was that a yes or a no? Mm-hmm.
Yes, prohibited. Let's call him father, people.
Okay, people let's earth. Explore that then. Let's explore that. So when Jesus is 12 years old, this is in Luke chapter 2, and his Mary and Joseph find him in the temple, Mary says to him, your father and I have been looking for you. And he's referring to Joseph as Jesus's father, meaning his adopted father, not his biological father, because he doesn't have a biological father. Would you say that Jesus would say that Mary broke the rule by referring to Joseph as Jesus's earthly father, about not calling other people father? Was Mary breaking that rule?
No.
Okay. No. How about when we look in the book of Acts and we find Stephen or Paul or other people addressing a gathering of Jews, and they say things like, brothers and fathers, I got this message for you. Are they breaking the rule that Jesus established?
I'm not sure, maybe.
Oh, maybe.
Not sure.
Okay. Let's then look at other New Testament authors like St. Paul. You would agree that when St. Paul writes his epistles, his letters, that they're divinely inspired, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So when St. Paul writes to Timothy, he refers to Timothy as his son. implying that he's Timothy's spiritual father. Did that break Jesus's rule? Bearing in mind, he's writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. No. Okay, when St. Paul writes to the Corinthians, he says, I became your father in the faith. Is St. Paul breaking the rule there?
It's probably no.
Okay.
No. When John writes to his readers, he refers to them as my little children, implying he's their father spiritually. Is he breaking Jesus's rule?
I don't think it's that. It's just probably like maybe Jesus wanted. I don't know really what he meant, but okay, I thought that's fine, literally. So
I would say when we look at the example that's set by the apostles, including when they're writing under divine inspiration, they could perfectly well describe themselves as spiritual fathers and their converts as their spiritual children. And that would not seem to break Jesus's rule, because the Holy Spirit was inspiring them to say this. And that would, you'd end up pitting what the Holy Spirit says against what Jesus said. So I would suggest that we have pretty good evidence that what Jesus meant was not don't ever use the word father for a human, but something much more restricted and commonsensical, like don't confuse the fatherhood of any human with the fatherhood of God. Does that sound reasonable, like something maybe you could think about in the future?
Yeah, it makes more sense.
Okay, awesome. So I hope that helps with that issue. Now, you also mentioned the issue of rituals. Okay, well, we don't have a lot of descriptions of what early Christian services were like. We have some indications. One of the things, and I won't go through it all, but I would make a few points. The first one is, if you look in the Old Testament, you know, they had the Jerusalem temple and they had a priesthood that they offered sacrifices, and the Psalms were, you know, basically the hymn book that they had choirs singing at the temple and so forth. You would agree that in the Old Testament, there were quite a lot of rituals that were part of Jewish worship, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So the question would then be, did God want Christians to overthrow all ritualism, or did he expect Christians to have some form of ritualism just like he had instructed the Jewish people to have? So, you know, we need to look for evidence and say, well, do we have any evidence that Jesus told the first Christians to chuck out all the ritual and not do any rituals anymore? I can't think of any passages where Jesus says anything like that. Can you?
No.
No, yeah. So given that we have a precedent in Jewish worship for using rituals, and Jesus never says, can all the rituals, guys, I would expect that precedent to inform Christian ritual. And in fact, we have evidence it did. You've probably heard the ending that some people use for prayers forever and ever, amen. That's actually a fusion of forever and ever, which is what they would say in the temple, and amen, which is what they'd say in the synagogue. And Christians fused those two as part of our own Christian prayer tradition. Also, Jesus gave us the Lord's Prayer as a model prayer to say. He also gave us the Lord's Supper, or as Catholics call it, the Eucharist, to be part of Christian worship, and that's a ritual. And then when we look in the book of Revelation that depicts what's going on in heaven, we see them using rituals up in heaven all the way through the book of Revelation. So I would say that there's a good bit of evidence in the New Testament that ritual is meant to be part of Christian worship. And this is really cool. A lot of people don't know this, but we actually have a description from the mid-second century. This is around the year AD 150. So this is like 100 years after the time of Jesus. We have a description of how early Christians worshiped. The early church father, St. Justin Martyr, he's writing to explain to non-Christians, here's what we do in our worship services, because there were a lot of rumors that we were committing crimes and cannibalism and stuff. So he writes to non-Christians to explain, no, guys, this is what we do in our service. And he outlines the Christian worship service, and it's the same as the Catholic Mass today. So the Catholic Mass, actually, we can show it being used all the way back to within 100 years of when Christ was crucified for us. So I would say we have good evidence from both the New Testament and from right after the New Testament that that indicates ritual is meant to be part of Christian worship. I'd like to also send you, Christian, a daily defense so that you can explore more questions, but I hope that what we've covered so far has been helpful.
Christian? All right. Christian's still on the line, so we can give him the book.
Okay.
Christian, if you'll hang on, we'd love to send that book to you. You said you left Catholicism. You were gracious enough to call us. As Jimmy said, please call back, and we'll continue the conversation, and perhaps you'll
hang on right now so we can get your address and send you the book.
Don't go anywhere, Christian. We want to send you the book. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Why Aren't You Catholic on Catholic Answers Live with our guest, Jimmy Akin.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 2013. EWTN News Nightly launches from Washington, D.C., bringing news and analysis from a Catholic perspective to TV viewers and radio listeners worldwide.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Lots of folks have been gracious enough to call us and tell us why they are not Catholic. We appreciate that. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. We're going to Springfield, Missouri now. Stuart is in Springfield, Missouri, and we're very grateful for the call. Stuart, why aren't you Catholic?
Well, let me.
Oh, hang on, Stuart. Hang on just a quick sec. Sorry.
Let me say howdy to Stuart. You're a neighbor of mine. You're just over the Missouri line.
Not too far away.
I got to go look at a map. I never know what's next to anything. Springfield, Missouri is right next to Arkansas. Is that what I'm supposed to accept here?
Just above. Correct. Yeah. Stuart's about an hour north of me. Away.
I'll believe it when I look at a map. You two go on with your conversation. I'm going to look right now.
Well, I actually am Catholic, but I work with a dispensationalist that is Bible alone. And we both love talking about Jesus, and so we get into frequent debates. And, of course, she's really heavy into prophecies and such. And there was something I was listening to somewhere, I can't remember where I heard it, but it sounded like, or just kind of like my eyes opened to the fact that all of the Old Testament prophecies have been fulfilled in Jesus. And so, like, you know, when she's talking about all these things and related to things today, is there something I can tell her or talk to her about it for the fact that they have all been fulfilled? Is that true, I guess?
Well, I wouldn't say they've all been fulfilled. I would say there many of them have been fulfilled, but there are still prophecies to be fulfilled at the second coming. And there are also Old Testament prophecies that in one way or another point to events in our future. What I would say is that the dispensationalist, the common dispensationalist belief that the book of Revelation and the central part of the book of Revelation, which is basically chapters four forward, that all of that material pertains to our future, I would say that's mistaken. And you're in luck because I just, not today, but last Friday, I had an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World come out where I look at the book of Revelation and I talk about the major theories about it. Dispensationalism is, and for people who may not be aware, dispensationalism is a theological system that really got started in the early 1800s. So it's very recent in church history. And it has a view of Revelation that is a variation of a position called futurism. And futurism holds that at least like chapter four of Revelation to the end of the book, all that information, all those passages are in our future. And that's one of four major interpretations of the book, futurism is. And in last Friday's episode of Mysterious World, which is episode 408, I go through those four major theories as well as a fifth minor theory, which does hold that all prophecy has finished. I talk about how these different positions developed, and I talk about evidence for and against them, and I end up ranking them in a tier list. So I think that would be very interesting for you to check out, and it gives you the basics of you know, how different positions on Revelation work and what I think is a reasonable approach to it. Your friend might also find it interesting. I also have other videos. If you search my channel on things like the Mark of the Beast or just Revelation, you'll find other videos I've done about Revelation and Bible prophecy. And you may find those interesting as background for yourself or just out of curiosity. Yeah. And they may be helpful for your friend as well. In fact, you could say, hey, I found this video. Why don't we watch it? And maybe we can discuss it afterwards.
Yeah. One other quick thing, I guess. So anytime, like, she's all Bible alone. So whenever I try to prove my point biblically, her argument is always, you know, well, that's your Bible. That's not the right Bible. So, I mean, I've tried to give her the history of how the Bible was compiled, but, you know, it just, she has none of that. So,
okay. Well, so for your additional research, I wrote a book a while back called, The Bible is a Catholic Book, and we'll send you a copy of that. You can read it. It'll give you more data. She might be interested in reading it at some point, but if she's really telling you, well, that's your Bible, that's not really relevant to the discussion of prophecy, because the only difference is in terms of the books that are in the Catholic Bible that are not in the Protestant Bible don't interact very much with prophecy. So you can appeal to the same book of Isaiah and the same book of Revelation and the same passages in the Gospels. They're not any different. Now, she might mean they're a different translation, but that really isn't relevant because Catholics and Protestants don't have translations these days that are substantially different from each other, unless she's like a King James onlyist or something.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I've told her. I was like, if you read both, I'll give you a copy of mine. You know, they're probably not that different, but, you know, I'm just curious more about the prophecy thing.
Yeah, I'd volunteer to read from her Bible. And, I mean, unless it's a really old one like the King James Bible, it's going to say pretty much the same thing that the Catholic Bible says.
Yeah. All right.
I've got good news for you. I looked on a map, and you were both correct. Arkansas is right next to Missouri. I learn something all the time.
Last week we had, I'm in Northwest Arkansas, so I've got Oklahoma just to the west and Missouri just to the north. And so hearing from neighbors on both sides these past 2 weeks.
Well, Stuart, thank you. Hang on. We want to send you the book. All right.
All right. Thank you.
Let's go down to Florida. Susan in Florida. Thank you for waiting, Susan. Why aren't you Catholic?
Well, I am Catholic, actually, and this is probably not the right format to be asking this
question. Let's give it a try. Let's see what you got.
Okay. I'm a cradle Catholic, and mm-hmm. I was brought up Catholic and kind of fell away, mm-hmm. but I did get mm-hmm. my children baptized, and also they received their first Holy Communion.
Mm-hmm.
But
good.
That's as far as it went. So I didn't follow through with all that, and I'm wondering... They don't go to church now. But if they mm-hmm. did come back to the church, do they need to receive their confirmation? Or mm-hmm. because they haven't received all the sacraments they should have up until now, mm-hmm. how does that work?
How old are your children? Are they adults or are they in between somewhere?
Old. Yeah, they're 40s and 50s.
Okay. So 40s, 50s. So the answer is they would need to be confirmed, and they need to take some education classes before that. But that's not the first thing they need to do. Basically, the first thing they need to do is go to confession. And they could make a general confession. You know, it doesn't have to be long, but it should mm-hmm. cover, you know, what they need to confess, any mortal sins that they can remember committing. And God will forgive the ones they don't remember because they're not deliberately holding anything back. So once they've gone to confession, well, they've already been initiated into the Eucharist. So they can, as soon as they've gone to confession, they can start receiving the Eucharist again. And then at their convenience, they can go ahead and get confirmed. But they can begin living lives as sacramental lives as Catholics as soon as they would go to confession.
Okay.
Or how would that work?
Susan, we missed something. I'm sorry. Could you just repeat that? I apologize.
Okay. How would they get confirmed? Do they need to take OCIA?
Well, they need to take some kind of education classes. It might or might not be OCIA, but basically there are different ways this could be handled. The thing to do would be once they have gone to confession and, you know, are living life as a Catholic again, mm-hmm. then they can approach either the pastor of their parish or one of the priests or the church secretary and say, I need to see about getting confirmed. And they can, in the parish, they can then hook them up with the process for how to do that there locally.
Okay. I just want to be ready, you know, in case they come back and they say, yeah, but I haven't been confirmed. Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you how to go about that, you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's real easy.
I keep praying
and
for
you
that
don't...
one day.
And praying for it is good. So is inviting them. You know, you can say, hey, I fell away and, you know, I didn't get you all the way through, but I've decided I need to, live life as a Catholic again now. And I want to make sure that I do what I would have done knowing what I know now, which is to help you. And so I'd like to help you come back to the church too.
Susan, we'll send you a copy of A Daily Defense as well. Maybe there's some questions that you could get answered there. I'm going to go quickly now to see if Garrett in Pennsylvania, can you ask your question quickly to give Jimmy a chance to answer it, Garrett?
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, Jimmy. My question is, how would I put it? It is, it would be, we don't have an infallible list of infallible dogmas.
Yeah.
Like, how exactly do I know what is infallible, what is not infallible?
Similar, gotcha, Garrett.
If I would ask a Protestant, how do you know what books go in the Bible? You know what I mean?
Okay. Well, you need to learn the criteria for when infallibility are engaged, and then you need to look at how a teaching has been articulated by the magisterium in order to know whether it's infallible. I wrote a whole book about church teaching and how it works. It's called Teaching with Authority. And if you'll hang on the line, Garrett, we'll get your address and send you a copy of the book. And you can read in it's basically a theological manual on this subject. So you can read in substantial detail about how to determine the different levels of authority that church teachings have, including all the way up to infallibility.
And Garrett, thank you for being quick with that question. And I know you will enjoy the book, so do hang on. Let us send you a copy of that. Thanks to everybody who called today. It was a real privilege to get to talk with folks, some searching for answers about the Catholic faith, some having objections to the Catholic faith. But Jimmy, I thank you for taking all those calls. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Oh, I didn't get to ask you what dropped on the Jimmy Akin podcast on Monday.
This week it was a debrief on the resurrection, and coming up on Monday, it's an interaction with Frank Turek.
All right.
Well, Protestant apologist.
Check out Jimmy Akin's YouTube channel. Check out his podcast wherever you get your podcasts, The Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin podcast. That will do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.